This is case number 73756, Century Surety Company v. Dean Andrew. This has come to us by way of the Federal District Court as an NRAP 5 matter. If counsel for the appellate, Mr. Grass, if you're ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
If I could reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, I'd appreciate it. May it please the court. My name is Rick Gass, and with Marty Kravitz, we represent Century Surety. Also in court is attorney Daniel Polzenberg, who authored the two supporting amici briefs that support Century's position. Both the amicus briefs and our briefs suggest to you that the answer to the question certified to you should be the rule that has been adopted by the majority of jurisdictions, and then just 9 or 10 days ago adopted by the American Law Institute. And we submitted on Friday, and there are hard copies that were made available for you today, the adoption by the American Law Institute of the restatement of the law of liability insurance, which has adopted the majority rule that holds, as we argue for today, that in the event there is a breach of the duty to defend by an insurance carrier, but not in bad faith, as already determined by the district federal court, by summary judgment dismissing all bad faith questions. If a carrier has breached the duty to defend without bad faith, is their exposure limited to the policy limits agreed to in the insurance contract, or is the minority rule the rule to be adopted, that the carrier is then liable for all consequential damages that might have flowed from that breach? How we got here today is through an accident where a gentleman by the name of Vasquez hits Andrew and causes him injury. He hits him with a personal vehicle.
Counsel, if I can just chide you a little bit. Since we are not predicated on good faith or bad faith the way it came over to us, it almost, the accident itself is inconsequential. The issue is how should we apply the law
right. In
this case.
And I was not going to the accident, but rather to the fact that Vasquez had a personal insurance policy and a business policy.
The court is very well aware of that.
Okay.
The court is very well aware of the fact that, without very little to explain to us, why they chose not to defend, so that is off the plate for us. So I'd
okay.
like to stay
in
the
middle. The bicyclist is Ryan Predator. Hmm? Am I correct?
Yes.
Not Andrew.
Right.
That's his sister.
Yes. I'm not here to do the nose counting of minority and majority, but I think the way we can help you is to give you our thoughts as to what's the better rule of law. And the American Law Institute, when it adopted the current restatement of the law of liability insurance, we have to keep in mind is composed of not just practicing attorneys on both sides of the V, but judges, appellate and trial judges, and law professors. Cardoza explained the restatement process and why I think this is such an important piece of supplemental authority for you. Cardoza, in a lecture, said, when finally the restatement goes out under the name and the sanction of the Institute, after all this testing and retesting, it will be something less than a code and something more than a treatise. it will be invested with unique authority not to command but to persuade. It will embody a composite thought and speak a composite voice. Universities, bench, and bar will have a part in its creation. I have great faith in the power of such a restatement to justify our law. That's where I think the better rule comes from, because the restatement adopted the position that the policy limits are the cap on damages. They are the contractual damages. There was no reason, if there was a reason for a distinction for good faith failure to defend, as the restatement does, and caps the damages at the policy limit, if there was a good reason for that, that should be the rule. And that's what the majority and the restatement arrived at, that there is a distinction.
As to this issue before the court, it appears that when you contract, you are entering into a contract to indemnify for whatever damage, and you also are agreeing to defend.
Correct.
Those are the two elements.
Two promises.
So,
yes.
In this case, for whatever reason, which we're not concerned with, they chose not to defend.
Correct.
Should there not be some consideration of foreseeability, so to speak, of on a case-by-case basis, or this pure ceding of economic damages limiting to this contract? And looking at the majority's viewpoint, if a party does not defend on their own after being noticed that their insurer is not going to defend, there does not seem to be any concern that they might not have the wherewithal, since they bought this insurance policy, to defend. Isn't that a consideration that the court might wish to entertain?
Generally, the courts that have looked at this issue say the foreseeability that's involved is the foreseeability at the time of contracting. And the consequence...
Well, let's stop right there. The foreseeability at the time of contracting. If I'm purchasing an insurance policy, I'm purchasing it so they will pay if for some reason I'm charged with a claim. And then secondly, they're going to defend me because I may not have the wherewithal to get someone to defend me in action. So now I'm in a situation where I've paid. I don't have money to pay for my own counsel. And you would leave me reading what I've read thus far only to the fact that if I spend money to be defended, I can be reimbursed for that. But nothing else. It stops right
no,
there.
No. You can be reimbursed for what you incurred plus up to the policy limits. If the carrier had gone ahead and defended, the policy limits would be available to pay any judgments. In this case, where the carrier had an argument to be resolved about coverage and did not defend, the insured should be put in the same position as if the carrier had defended, and that is have available the full policy limits plus any personal
costs.
So
you're saying the burden is then on the insured, the party who has purchased this insurance, to sue his own carrier if his carrier says, I'm not going to defend you prior to anything going forward?
Yes. It could come about in any number of ways. There could be the suit by the insured, or there could be the deck action filed by a plaintiff. There could be a deck action filed by the insurance carrier. And why? That's one of the reasons why the better rule is to cap it at the policy limits, because this isn't just a potential burden on the insurance carrier of having to defend claims for which they have no coverage. It would encourage suits that would put a burden on the court system.
What about the burden on the person who purchases the insurance?
Yes. It's like any contract action.
It seems a very one-sided contract the way you're explaining it to me right now.
No, it actually is a one-sided burden on the carrier, because if the minority rule is enacted, accepted by you, then every carrier in any dispute over coverage, it might be over whether there was the person making a claim for insurance wasn't insured, for example. Or it might be an exclusion because the date of the occurrence wasn't within the policy time period. If the minority rule is enacted, no carrier could take the risk of ever denying coverage. It would have to protect itself, pay for a defense lawyer to defend on the merits, and seek a declaratory judgment. Filing as another suit that would put a burden on the judicial system and incurring all of that cost that would ultimately have to be built into insurance premiums.
As we are here today, I don't think the burden on the judicial system really matters. We're going to have that anyway.
Well, it's just another suit that would not be necessary.
Well, it depends on which side of the aisle you're standing on.
Well, every time there is an occurrence, the carrier has to look at, is that a covered loss? Reasonable minds can differ. The insured may say, this was not an assault and battery in this bar fight. The carrier may say, we think the assault and battery exclusion applied. That can be a reasonable difference of opinion. When you all issue opinions, you have not all seven or six of you completely unanimous. There could be dissenting opinions, concurring opinions, reasonable differences of mind. The majority rule allows for those reasonable differences to be resolved in litigation without the penal rule of the minority of saying all consequential damages are potential, even though you only contracted for $1 million of coverage. It ought to be treated, the insurance contract ought to be treated just like any other contract. Let me give you an example. Let's suppose I'm the seller of widgets, and you buy $60,000 of widgets from me, but you don't pay me. And I then sue you for the $60,000. The minority rule would say, when you breach the contract, you're responsible not just for the amount in the contract, but for the consequential damages. And my profit of $6,000, I was going to invest in the stock market just before it made the big move this year. So my damages aren't just $6,000, it's $60,000.
I have a question about I don't mean to disrupt this, but on the restatement section 48 that you're offering, I'd like you to address comment D, as in dog, the first sentence, and it raises the issue of consequential damages. It says this section follows the ordinary contract law rules regarding consequential damages, recognizing that the nature and extent of loss that is likely to be foreseeable by liability insurers at the time of contracting is quite extensive, particularly for breach of the duty to defend. Do you see that language?
Is that on page 419?
It is, at the very bottom, like line 27 through 29.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I think what helps
What do you think that comment is addressing?
I think the concept of there are contract damages and then there are consequential damages. As I was just in my widgets example, the contract damages are limited to the $60,000, but consequential damages are whatever the consequences are out into the future. And that's part of why I think the restatement authors adopted the majority rule, because there is no ending point for consequential damages. And just like the law of contracts developed to draw a bound or a fence around contractual damages, those that will flow from the foreseeability at the time of contracting. The law recognizes that that may be somewhat artificial, that there may be other consequential damages, but the law had to draw a line. It had to do a balance for both of the contracting parties. And I think that's what's behind comment D.
Thank you.
Anyone else have additional questions?
I do. I have a hypothetical, sir. I don't think the stock market investment would be recoverable. I mean, I think that's a little attenuated there. But what about this example? Let's say in Nevada we have $25,000 as the limits in liability insurance. And I know I buy insurance not so much for the $25,000 but for the coverage. If I drive to California and I get an accident, I want to be covered, and I want to have the insurance company defend it. Now, if I go in there, and let's say I get an accident in California, and the insurance company says, gee, we'll just throw in the 25 and you're on your own on the attorney's fees, and you pay those out of your own pocket. We're washing our hands. We're gone. Now, is that hypothetical correct under the majority view that you're advocating?
There's a lot in there.
Well, just do, can you pay the 25 if that's the limits of the policy and walk away?
Then
the insured's on their own at that stage.
Yes. Virtually every policy, there is what's called walk-away language, that you can pay the limits to the other side. If they won't accept them, then you get into whatever is the law of that particular state of paying them into court or however else you do it. And it gets us into a whole big other question of if there are multiple claimants, how it gets shared.
I understand, but if it was a major accident, the 25 maybe doesn't even cover the special damages, and the other, the plaintiff's lawyer in that case says, I'm not taking it. I can collect from you. You're good for it.
Right.
So we're not going to do it. And you say, well, we'll interplead it into court or whatever, and we're done. And you rest your insured, you're on your own.
Right. First step is, looking at the policy to see what kind of language it has and does it have walk-away coverage.
Okay.
Any additional questions at this time?
Yes, I do have one additional.
Justice Hardison.
Following up on Justice Givens' hypothetical, why is it not contractually feasible, foreseeable, I should say, that one who is not defended will end up with a damage verdict or judgment against them higher than policy limits?
It depends on the facts that may be known to the carrier as to the accident and the injuries. It also depends on the type of policy language that is has dispute or has a question over. In the application of the assault and battery exclusion, there may be very inflammatory damages if in truth and fact it is an assault and battery. So that's a very fact-specific situation that each carrier and each situation would have to look at.
So why wouldn't, you're suggesting that then that there are cases in which damages would be assessed against your insured, a party's insured, in excess of policy limits in the absence of a defense.
Right. I think.
So my question is this, and I get the connection and the tether to breach of contract and contract damage principles in this argument. But for me, the question is whether or not there are circumstances in which the insured who goes undefended will incur foreseeable damages in excess of the policy limit simply because they were not defended.
Right. And I think that got hashed out with all of the competing interests in the huge debate inside of the American Law Institute, and they took into account your exact kind of hypothetical.
Well, that's why I think Justice, I don't know why Justice Pickering asked the question, but that was my question about comment D.
Right.
Because it seems that that comment leaves open the question.
Well,
in those circumstances in which there has been a breach of the duty to defend, and it is foreseeable that the recovery or the assessed damages will exceed policy limits, then the rule ought to allow for the recovery of not just the limits, but those damages assessed above the limits. Why shouldn't we consider that under the rule?
At that point, if that is the end rule, then there is no distinction between situations where a carrier acts in good faith versus when a carrier acts in bad faith. If they're going to be the same damages because they are foreseeable in that way, then there is no distinction. Then all of the majority courts had the wrong rule. The restatement had the wrong rule. All of those saw a distinction. And the distinction is the good faith, not bad faith, and then having to set a boundary.
So your answer focuses on the distinction between a bad faith determination, not on contractual recovery principles.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then,
Counsel, at this point, you've used up all your time. I'm going to give you 3 minutes in rebuttal. Anyhow, because we used your time, Mr. Prince, I'm going to give you an additional 4 minutes to your argument if you need it.
Thank you. And before you start, I'd like to ask you a question. We've heard a lot about widgets. I want to hear about the injuries of Mr. Prentner.
Very well. And if it pleases the court, Dennis Prince and Kevin Strong on behalf of the respondent, Dana Andrew, who is the guardian for Mr. Prentner. Starting with your question first, Justice Cherry, Mr. Prentner suffered a severe brain injury. He was knocked off of his bicycle. He was transferred to the brain injury facility in Colorado. He remains in a very significant compromised cognitive state and has more than $3 million in medical expenses and is permanently and functionally disabled.
What was the comment of the insurance company when you asked them to defend?
They refused. As Judge Gordon noted, I provided a courtesy copy of the complaint, which clearly outlined allegations of that Mr. Vasquez, the owner of Blue Streak, was in the course and scope of his employment. Those allegations were reviewed by an in-house attorney, Lisa Henderson. She reviewed that with her manager, Daniel Meyer, who is also a lawyer within the legal department, and they chose not to provide a defense. In turn, I provided them a copy of the defaults and requested that they contact me, and they told me, they sent me back, said there's no coverage, Progressive's handling the matter, and they closed the file. And so that was the conduct of Century Surety Company. And in this case, had they provided a defense, assuming what they're saying, assuming it's true, that he was not in the course and scope of his employment, Blue Streak would have had a complete defense, and if the facts were as clear as they say, could have got out on summary judgment. But as just
And you're asking us to adopt the minority rule.
I'm asking you to adopt well-settled Nevada contractual insurance, Nevada contractual standards, that is well-settled that all contracting parties are liable for the foreseeable consequential damages they cause by reason of their breach. Further, an industry with a level of sophistication, power, resources, and superior bargaining strength than the parties they contract with do not deserve a special exception to the generally recognized rule by this state for decades that all contracting parties are liable for foreseeable consequential damages. And to answer your question specifically, we've counted. There are 10 states that adopt this position that in the absence of bad faith, you can't recover more than the stated policy limit. We've counted 9 states that have adopted our position. The states that adopt our position, which is California in the Archdale case, which this court cited in Miller, Allstate Miller, Illinois, Wisconsin, Georgia, Michigan, Montana, Kentucky, North Carolina, and Colorado. So I'm going to say there's a split of authority. But since Mr. Gass brought up the restatement, I want to point out to you how much in error he truly is. It's section 48 of the restatement. This just came up, the restatement of insurance law. And it starts, the section starts out by reading, the damages that an insured may recover for breach of a liability insurance policy include, they include, and they describe 4 subsections. Subpart 4, any other loss, including incidental or consequential loss caused by the breach, provided that loss was foreseeable by the insurer at the time of contracting as a probable result of the breach, which are sums are not subject to any policy limit. So contrary to what Mr. Gass just told you, that is not an accurate statement of what the restatement actually says. Justice Pickering raised comment D, which in part reads, this section allows for ordinary contract law rules regarding consequential damages, recognizing the nature and extent of the loss that is likely to be foreseeable by liability insurers at the time of contracting, going to your point, Justice Hardesty, is quite extensive. And they go on to say that it could be far in excess of the policy limit. The final wording of the section D of the comment section, and it says, and these damages, they are outside the scope of the policy limits. It was not too, you don't have to look too far into the future to see that at the time of contracting by a liability insurance company, if they're not provided with a defense, an insured, the damages could be well exceed the policy limits and in fact be catastrophic. That's exactly the type of promise that an insurance company makes. If you really step back for a second and understand what a liability insurer does, they only do 2 things. It's really as sophisticated as it is. It's very simple. They do 2 things. Number one, they pay claims. That's a duty to indemnify. And 2, they defend lawsuits. They provide litigation insurance. The promise to provide a defense is litigation insurance. And as this court noted in Miller, the Allstate Miller case, the duty to defend has 2 components to it, which we have to be clear in our mind about. The one is the right to control settlement negotiations, which this court concluded creates the duty of good faith and fair dealing. The second is the right to control litigation, and that's what we're talking about in this case. The right to control litigation creates a duty to defend an insured from lawsuits within the policy coverage. That's exactly what we're talking about here. There keeps being this discussion that comes up by Mr. Gass, as well as in the papers, that this was they've acted in good faith, and it was a good faith mistaken refusal. There is nothing about any of their conduct which was a mistake, and there's nothing about it that was in good faith. They seem to take the leap that if you act in, you don't act in bad faith, the inverse of that must be good faith. If you materially breach a covenant, an essential covenant under the policy of insurance, that it could never be described as being in good faith. But more importantly, which Judge Gordon found in his opinion on September 28, 2015, that they knew about the underlying complaint, that it was alleged that Vasquez was working in the course and scope of his employment, and knew there was a default. And he described their conduct as abandonment. That conduct can never be seriously taken as someone acting in good faith or operating under a simple mistake. This court has undertaken over a period of decades, great steps to ensure that the bargaining positions between the parties between an insurance contract are level. You've recognized that there's an imbalance of power. You've recognized the contracts are ones of adhesion. You've recognized the relationship is one of a special relationship and special confidence, It's even been described in both in the Powers case as well as Allstate Miller as being fiduciary in nature. And this court recognized in the Allstate Miller case that the insurance company has an obligation to protect the interests of their insured and at a minimum equally consider their interests as well as their own in making any decision, including the important decision of controlling the litigation. Think about the reserved power that an insurer has. They completely control, without input from their insured, the right to settle the claim, except maybe in a professional policy situation like a malpractice policy.
Mr. Prince, I don't know if other states have dealt with this issue legislatively. You said it's 10 to 9 on as far as the judicial interpretation and all, but is this the type of issue that should be dealt with legislatively as opposed to judicially?
I haven't seen it dealt with legislatively, Justice Gibbons. I've only seen it dealt with judicially,
okay,
and that's the only time I've seen it. But I also want to talk about the standards regarding the duty to defend, because when Mr. Gass is discussing with you the maybe an insurer has the right, there's a dispute over whether coverage applies or not. That only relates to the duty to pay claims, right? The duty of indemnity. We're talking about here a separate duty. It's completely an apple versus an orange. We're not, on the other hand, we're talking about the duty to defend a lawsuit. And the way this court has described it consistently over the years, the duty to defend is triggered where there is even a potential for coverage. Even the potential for coverage, that's the standard. It doesn't matter if the carrier believes the facts are different, that they don't fall within the scope of coverage, based upon their investigation. It is enough that the allegation, the complaint, support a potential for coverage. And in the Frontier Insurance case, this court left no room for confusion of just how important it is for this duty to defend. And it held this: if there is any doubt whether there's a duty to defend or not, you must provide the defense, which is consistent with the longstanding principle for ambiguity in the policy. We're going to construe that against the carrier because of their superior bargaining position, power, strength, and resources. And I want to, before I move on, I want to talk about this. As this court said in Frontier Insurance, the purpose behind construing the defend so broadly is to prevent insurers from evading this obligation, this being the duty to defend, like precisely what happened here. Because it can be a strategy, right? Think about this. We're going to deny coverage, and hopefully that discourages anybody from coming forward, and maybe there won't be a lawsuit filed, and maybe if there's a lawsuit filed, no one will look to us. But if they do come to us someday, we're going to say, oh, hey, we had a good faith belief that no coverage applied, even though we didn't provide a defense, and there's a catastrophic judgment against our policyholder. This doesn't just apply to individuals, but it also applies to businesses, big or small. One of the most important, as described by the court in California, the great court in Commonall, the duty to defend is probably even of greater importance to a policyholder than the duty to indemnify, to pay the claim. Think about a business that supplies materials, and all of a sudden their materials are defective, and say it affects hundreds of houses, pools. And now all of a sudden they're going to be faced with dozens, if not hundreds, of lawsuits. They will really want to call upon the carrier for their superior resources, sophistication, and litigation experience to defend them. But if the carrier says, no, we don't think that's a covered claim, we're not going to provide you with a defense, even though the allegations trigger that duty, and accepting those as true, there would be otherwise coverage. Think about how catastrophic that would be, not just for individuals, but for businesses alike. And to answer your question, Justice Gibbons, about can they just simply deposit the money in court and walk away? This court addressed that issue in the Benchmark Insurance versus Sparks. And in the absence of very clear and precise language, they cannot do that. That does not discharge their duty. Because as this court has made clear, when the duty to defend is triggered, you have to defend to the end. You have to defend all the way through the conclusion of litigation, through judgment or settlement, whatever that means. And so for those reasons, it is construed so broadly. Now,
but what about the traditional contract damages, distinguishing them from tort damages? And you have the benefit of the bargain, like, and I'm reminded, although imperfectly, of law school, where you have a telegraph company that the telegraph doesn't go through, and as a result, you know, for one of the nails, the shoe was lost, there's all kinds
right.
of...
That's the Hadley versus Baxendale argument. I think the contract damages are already limited by the concept of foreseeability. And as you noted in Allstate Miller, the tort damages or any all damages proximately caused, whether foreseeable or not. They're not limited by foreseeability. That's what makes the distinction so significant. It's the foreseeability component of it. The indemnity limit is really an agreement to pay how much you're going to pay a third party. And as the court and the Supreme Court of California common law noted, that limit has no impact on the damages that the insurer may cause as policyholder.
Right, but I'm asking a bit of a different question, which is the duty to defend. Let's just stay with that for a moment. I promise I'm going to defend you.
Right.
And if I don't, the benefit of the bargain was, you get to pay another lawyer to defend you. So that's the obvious benefit of the bargain that you had. You don't necessarily get the best lawyer. You get your reasonable expectation of the lawyer who is going to defend you. So when you go from breach of the duty to defend, leaving indemnity off the table for a moment, I don't know that you can, but that breach would be quantifiable according to your benefit of your bargain, which is you gave me a dollar to defend you and I didn't defend you. But am I then liable if I don't show up for your trial for the disaster that befalls you? If it were pure duty to defend and no other obligations, probably not, right?
I think even under the position cited by Century, that number one, that you're entitled to receive not only any costs you incur by way of attorney's fees and costs defending litigation, but also up to the policy limit.
Right.
And so there's two components to a damage claim. One is the expectancy component, and this court has adopted Section 347 of the Restatement Second of Contracts in the roadway builder's case. And the expectancy damage in this context would be the policy limit.
Right.
However, in addition to that, under 347B, you also get to recover consequential damages for anything that was reasonably foreseeable by reason of the breach. So you get both. So on one hand, it would be, in this case, be the $1 million policy limit plus the $17 million of the consequence that you caused by reason of your failure to defend. So you have to look at it in both contexts. So the expectancy or the benefit of the bargain is simply the 347A damage, the expectancy, which in this case I believe would be the policy limit, and the Section 347B damages would be all the consequences as a result of your breach, which fits very consistently with how this court has viewed consequential damages. For example, in Hornwood, isn't this almost virtually identical to the situation in Hornwood? Century, if I'm not mistaken, the same position as Smith's in Hornwood. Century argues, hey, you're only entitled to our policy limit. Well, in Hornwood, Smith's argument was, even though we've left the store, we've devalued the center, we're still paying rent, that's all you can expect to recover. This court disagreed and said, no, you can recover not only the full amount of the rent due under the lease the next 15 years, because they left vacated early, but you also can recover the consequential damages, not just the expectancy, for as a result of the devaluation of the center, as well as the other damages caused by Smith vacating the premises early. And as a result of that, I believe that you can create a scenario where the damage is already limited by foreseeability, and it'll be a case-by-case determination what damages would be foreseeable. And in this particular case, Judge Gordon made the conclusion that a default judgment by reason of not providing a defense would be a foreseeable consequence of the failure to provide a defense when you had notice of the action, understood the allegations, and made the business decision, the conscious decision, to not provide a defense. The insurance policy limit should not function, in effect, as a liquidated damage provision because it bears no relationship to the duty to defend. For example, to your example, Justice Gibbons, let's assume you cause a catastrophic injury and you only have a 25 policy and the plaintiff or the claimant doesn't want to accept the limits and they want to file a lawsuit against you. It may cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, even in the seven figures, to potentially defend the lawsuit. There is no prescribed limit for what an insurer must pay in order to properly fulfill its obligation under the policy to defend a policyholder through the conclusion of the litigation. Now, there's an easy option to resolve all of this. There is a safe harbor for Century, which it uniquely understands as a sophisticated professional litigant, because liability insurers are professional litigants. They could have simply provided a defense by issuing a reservation of rights letter. They could have successfully, under their theory, if the facts were as they believed they were so clear, that Blue Streak would have successfully defended that it was not liable under a respondeat superior theory. They could have provided a defense and filed a declaratory relief action. And this court is well known, virtually all of you were trial judges before you took the bench. Insurers are probably the most frequent users, except Justice Chickering, most frequent users of the declaratory relief process, both in state court and in federal court. It is well known to them, and they are frequent users of it, and they use it to their advantage when they feel they need to at all times. They clearly know how to use that process, and that would have been an easy way to avoid all of this. And as Judge Herndon, who ironically we talked about Judge Herndon earlier this morning, he was also the trial judge in this case when they sought to intervene in the underlying case, and he described their conduct as simply sticking their head in the sand and not caring about what happened, and he didn't allow them to intervene, and he later didn't allow them to set aside the judgment, and you denied their writ relief seeking to overturn the underlying judgment.
Mr. Prince, what if a properly defended lawsuit would have resulted in $18 million in damages anyway? Is that of any consequence?
On a theory of a duty to defend, no, it would have. It would only, then they'd only be liable for the $1 million, likely, assuming they didn't reject a policy in this demand when they had a reasonable opportunity to do so. If it was strictly under a duty to defend analysis, then if it was properly defended, then the answer to your question would be subject to the $1 million policy limit. But since that did not happen, and in using their theory that Blue Streak did nothing wrong, that would have been an easy defense verdict or potentially summary judgment. And I don't think we're blurring asking you to adopt this rule, which is consistent with your long-standing rule on contractual damages, because the bad faith tort remedy provides a whole different scope of a remedy, because you actually have to demonstrate not only was the conduct unreasonable, but there was either awareness or an implied awareness that it was unreasonable at the time. And it's all damages proximately caused, which could include general damages, meaning pain, suffering, stress, anxiety for even having to go through the process, and trigger a potential claim for punitive damages. So the remedy is distinct. The particular concern dealing with the cases that the Century relies upon is they don't really do a deep dive in the distinct analysis between what's a contractual-based remedy and what's a tort remedy. They just simply conclude that, no, this is how it is. And Century's trying to suggest to the court, just get in line, Nevada, follow the majority. But as Justice Stiglitz said when she authored the opinion in Ford versus Trujillo, even though many courts are moving in a different direction, particularly in the products case, risk utility analysis, that we're going to follow longstanding Nevada public policy. And we're urging you to do that in following the longstanding policy of this state regarding consequential damages for all contracting parties and not create a new rule, which would be a disincentive to fulfill their obligation under the policy. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Rebuttal.
For all of the disparagement that Mr. Prince did against Century in dealing with this, he forgot to tell you that Judge Gordon signed an order on April 29, 2014 that says, summary judgment is entered in favor of Century on plaintiff's claims of bad faith and violation of the Unfair Claims Practices Act. So everything he told you that was negative about Century has been found by Judge Gordon to not be bad faith.
Why did he use the word abandonment then?
Pardon me?
Why did Judge Gordon use the word abandonment when he was talking about what Century did? He said abandonment.
Well, it was a word to describe the failure to defend. The other thing that Mr. Prince didn't tell you when he was reading to you from Section 48 of the American Law Institute about point 4, that says any other loss, including incidental or consequential, you have to look at number 3 first, because what happens inside of Section 48 is the drafters switch, and number 3 says, in the event of a breach of the duty to make reasonable settlement decisions, the damages are stated in Section 27 and 4. So there has to be, before you get to the consequential damages in the ALR restatement, there has to be the tortious conduct that Justice Pickering raised of tortious bad faith, and that isn't in this case. Thirdly, you need to know that Mr. Vasquez was defended in this case. He was being defended by Progressive, his personal auto carrier that assigned a lawyer to him and was providing a defense to him when Century rejected the claim. On the counting of heads, the actual count, I think, is 20 versus 6. And you can do your own count. The inventory is in Mr. Polsenberg's brief on behalf of the Federation of Defense and Corporate Counsel.
Counsel, you are now out of time.
Thank you, Judge.
I thank counsel for both sides for this argument this day. It put a lot on the plate. With that, we stand in recess. This matter will be